This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Masterpiece by Fiona Davis. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell. Chapter 1. New York City, April 1928. Clara Darden's illustration class at the Grand Central School of Art, tucked under the copper eaves of the terminal, was unaffected by the trains that rumbled through ancient layers of Manhattan schist hundreds of feet below. But somehow, a surprise visit from Mr. Lorette, the school's director, had the disruptive power of a locomotive weighing in at thousands of tons. Even before Mr. Lorette was a factor, Clara had been anxious about the annual faculty exhibition set to open at 6 o'clock that evening, her first show in New York City, and everyone important in the art and editorial worlds would be there. She'd been working on her illustrations for months now, knowing this might be her only chance. She asked her class to begin work on an alternate cover design for Virginia Woolf's latest book, and the four ladies dove in eagerly, while Wilbur, the only male and something of a rake to boot, sighed loudly and rolled his eyes. Gertrude, the most studious of the five members, was so offended by Wilbur's lack of respect that she threatened to toss a jar of turpentine at him. They were still arguing vociferously when Mr. Lorette waltzed in. Never mind that these were all adults, not children. Whenever Wilbur made a ruckus, it had the unfortunate effect of lowering the entire class's maturity level by a decade. More often than not, Clara was strong enough to restore order before things went too far. But Mr. Lorette seemed possessed of a miraculous talent for sensing the rare occasions during which Clara lost control of the room, and he could usually be counted upon to choose such times to wander by and assess her skills as an educator. "Miss Darden, do you need additional supervision again?" Mr. Lorette's bald pate shone as if it had been buffed by one of the shoeshine boys in the terminal's main concourse. The corners of his mouth curled down, even when he was pleased, while his eyebrows moved independently of each other, like two furry caterpillars trying to scurry away. Even though he was only in his early 30s, he exuded the snippety nature of a judgmental great aunt. He'd been appointed director 3 years earlier, after one of the school's illustrious founders, John Singer Sargent, passed away. The school had increased in reputation and enrollment with each new term, and Mr. Lorette had given himself full credit for its smashing success when he'd interviewed Clara. She'd been promoted from student monitor to interim teacher after Mr. Lorette's chosen instructor dropped out at the last minute, putting her on uneven footing from the beginning. It hadn't helped that the class had shriveled to 5 from an initial January enrollment of 15. 10 of those early enrollees had walked out on the first day, miffed at having a woman in charge. Mr. Lorette's dissatisfaction, and the likelihood that she'd not be asked back next term, mounted each week, which meant tonight's faculty show would probably be her last opportunity to get her illustrations in front of the city's top magazine editors. Since coming to New York the year before, Clara had dutifully dropped off samples of her work at the offices of Vogue and McCall's every few months, to no avail. The responses ranged from the soul-crushing, unoriginal no, to the encouraging try again later. All that would change tonight, she hoped. By seeing her work in the hallowed setting of the Grand Central Art Galleries, alongside the well-known names of other faculty members, the editors would finally appreciate what she had to offer. Even better, as the only illustrator on the faculty, she was sure to stand out. Mr. Lorette cleared his throat. "No, sir, we don't need any assistance. Thank you for checking in." She maneuvered around to the front of the table where she'd been working, in an attempt to block his view of her own sketches. No luck. He circled around and stood behind it, his nose twitching. "What is this?" "Some figures I was working on to demonstrate the use of compass points to achieve the correct proportions." "I thought you'd covered that already. You can never go back to the basics enough." He offered a suspicious nod before winding his way through the tables, his eyes darting from drawing board to drawing board. Her students stood back, hoping for a kind word. "Why is it each student seems to be drawing something completely different from the others?" She nodded at the novel she'd left out on the still life table. "The assignment was to create a cover for a book. I encouraged them to use their imaginations." "Their examples of lighthouses and beaches are apropos, yet you are drawing undergarments?" Even if he had been a more sympathetic man, there was no way to explain how the hours stretched painfully long with her having so few students, how the skylights diffused the light in a way that made each day, whether sunny or overcast, feel exactly like every other. She routinely made the rounds, suggesting that a dry brush would work best to create texture, or offering encouragement when Gertrude became frustrated. But at some point, the students had to be left alone to get to their work. Which was why today she'd pulled a chair up to a drawing table and sketched out the figures for her latest commission from Wanamaker Department Store. 3 pages of chemises for the summer catalog. The work paid a pittance, but at least it was something. "This is for tomorrow's class," she lied. "As we do not have a live model to work from, I was planning on using a work of my own to guide them." As she hoped, the mention of her standing request for a model redirected his attention. His voice rose in pitch to that of a schoolgirl.
"The students are free to take a life class at any time. This is an illustration class, and right now our models are reserved for the fine arts classes. As you said, they can use their imaginations, no?"
"But it is not ideal. If we can have a model to understand the anatomy underneath the fashions, to have the model begin nude and then add layers of clothing, we could build upon what we've learned already." She never meant to be ornery, but somehow Mr. Lorette brought out a stubbornness in her every time.
"As yours is a class of mixed genders taught by a woman, having a nude model would be most inappropriate. I'm sorry you find our school so deficient, Miss Darden."
He clucked his tongue, which made her want to reach into his mouth and pull it out.
"The other instructors, who have vastly more experience than you do, seem to manage just fine."
The other instructors, all men, had their every whim met by Mr. Lorette. She'd seen it in action. The director encouraging them to stop by his office for a smoke, the group laughing at some private joke, the director's feet propped up on his desk in an attempt to convey casual masculinity. Clara didn't fit the mold, which made her vulnerable. "I'm sure we can manage, sir." He shuffled off, closing the door behind him. She directed the class to continue. Gertrude's work had only 3 rips from her overuse of the razor for corrections, a record low for her. "Your stormy clouds are exquisite, but where would the lettering of the title and author go?" Clara asked. Gertrude rubbed her nose with her wrist, leaving a gray streak at the tip. "Right. I got so caught up, I forgot." Clara pointed to the top edge. "Try a damp sponge on the wet areas to lift out some color." The girl was always eager, even if her strong hand was better suited to clay or oils than to the careful placement of watercolor, where mistakes were difficult to correct. Use too much water, and a brilliant cauliflower pattern would bloom where a smooth line ought to have been. Too dry, and the saturated color would stick to the page, resisting softening. But Clara loved watercolor in spite of, or perhaps because of, its difficult temperament. The way the paper shone after a wash of cool orange to convey a sunset. how the colors blended together in the tray to form new ones that probably didn't even have a name. Finally, 5 o'clock came around. The students stored their artwork in the wooden racks, and once the room was empty, Clara hid her own sketches up on the very top of the storage cabinet, away from Mr. Lorette's prying eyes. Starving, she headed downstairs to the main concourse, where cocoa-pink walls trimmed in Botticino marble soared into the air. Electrically lit stars and painted constellations twinkled along the turquoise-vaulted ceiling. Although the poor artist had inadvertently painted the sky backward, a mistake the art students loved to remark upon. The first time she'd entered the hallowed space, stepping off the train from Arizona last September, she'd stopped and stared, her mouth open, until a man brushed past her, swearing under his breath at her inertia. The vastness of the main concourse, where sunshine beamed through the giant windows and bronze chandeliers glowed, left her gobsmacked. With its exhilarating mix of light, air, and movement, the terminal was the perfect location for a school of art. Since then, she'd been sure to glance up quickly before joining in what seemed like an elaborate square dance of men and maids, of red-capped porters and well-dressed society ladies, all gliding by one another at various angles, yet never colliding. She liked best to lean over the banister on the west balcony and watch the patterns of people flowing around the circular information booth, which sat in the middle of the floor, its four-faced clock tipped with a gleaming gold acorn. Her stomach growled. She followed a group of smartly dressed men down the ramp to the suburban concourse and into the Grand Central Terminal restaurant, where she secured a seat at the counter. "Miss Darden?" A young woman wearing a black velvet coat trimmed with fur hovered behind Clara, offering an inquisitive smile. "Yes, I thought that might be you. I'm Nadine Stevenson. I take painting classes at the school. You're having a bite before the show." "I am, Miss Stevenson." "Oh, now, call me Nadine." Nadine's nose was large, her eyes close together and deep set. Her right eye was slightly larger than the left, and the asymmetry was unsettling but powerful. Clara couldn't help but imagine how Picasso might approach her, all mismatched cubes and colors. Next to her stood an Adonis of a man, whose symmetrical beauty offered a fascinating counterpoint. Shining blue-gray eyes under arched brows, hair the color of wheat. "And this is Mr. Oliver Smith, a friend and poet." Even though Clara had hoped to eat dinner in peace, she didn't have much of a choice. "Lovely to meet you both. Please join me." They took the stools next to her as the waiter stopped in front of them, pen in hand. Clara ordered the oyster stew, as did Oliver. Nadine requested peeled muscat grapes, followed by a lobster cocktail. Many of the young girls at the Grand Central School of Art had enrolled only so they could list it in their wedding announcement someday, a creative outlet that wouldn't threaten future in-laws. Nadine seemed to fall into that category, with her airs and pearls. "Miss Darden is the only lady teacher at the Grand Central School of Art," said Nadine to Oliver. "She teaches illustration." She turned to Clara with a bright smile. "Now tell us about what you'll be showing tonight." "Four illustrations that depict four seasons of high fashion." Clara couldn't help but elaborate. She'd put so much thought into the drawings. "For example, the one for winter depicts three women draped in fur coats, walking poodles sporting matching pelts." "Well, that sounds pleasant." Was Nadine making fun of her? Clara couldn't tell. She'd hardly had time to socialize, other than occasionally trading a few words with some of the other women artists who lived in her Greenwich Village apartment house. She'd been far too busy trying to make a living. Nadine placed one hand on the counter and leaned in closely. The citrus scent of emerode perfume drifted Clara's way. Did you know that Georgia O'Keeffe, she does those astonishing flowers, was a commercial artist at first? There's no need to be ashamed of it. Not at all. Illustration is a common stepping stone into the true arts. I'm not ashamed in the least. The audacity. Clara didn't enjoy being talked down to by a student. I don't intend to do the true arts, Nadine, as you put it. I enjoy illustration. It's what I do best. Well, I adore my life drawing and painting class. I'm learning so much from my instructor, Mr. Zakarian. He made me class monitor, and he's magnificent. Jealousy pinged. None of Clara's students would describe her in such superlative terms. Of that, she was quite certain. Class monitor. That's quite an honor. Do you plan on becoming an artist, then? Nadine gave out a squeak of a laugh. Oh, dear, no. I'm only taking classes for personal enrichment. The waiter dropped off their bowls, and for a moment nothing was said. If Clara had been alone, she would have surreptitiously folded a dozen or so oyster crackers into her handkerchief to have something to snack on before bed. The poet, who'd been silent the entire time, finally spoke.
My mother was an artist, although my father insisted she give it up after they married. She's been sick lately, but she very much misses going to museums and exhibits.
I'm sorry to hear that, offered Clara. Nadine mentioned that you're a poet.
Nadine is too kind in her description of me. Struggling poet, you might say. I suppose I take after my mother in that regard, having an innate love of the arts. My father is hoping I'll give it up eventually and go into banking.
Nadine placed a protective hand on his arm. Oliver was accepted to Harvard and refused to go. Can you imagine? Instead, he's slumming it with us bohemians. By all accounts, Nadine was hardly slumming it. But Clara understood firsthand what it was like to disappoint your family.
When I told my father I was moving to New York, he told me to not bother coming back. It's not an easy decision, but I'm glad I made it.
Oliver's blue eyes danced.
So there's hope for us miscreants.
Never. They shared a look, a quick, knowing smile that sent Clara's pulse racing. Usually, men didn't give her a second glance. Her father generously described her as ethereal for her blonde hair, pale skin, and towering, skinny figure. Her mother said she looked washed out and encouraged her to wear clothes that added color to her complexion, but Clara preferred blacks and grays. Her ghostly pallor and height had always been sore points, embarrassing, and she preferred to avoid drawing attention to herself. Oliver tucked into his stew. She did the same, embarrassed. She must have imagined the exchange. Nadine took over the reins of the conversation.
Now, where are you from, Miss Darden?
Arizona. She waited for the inevitable intake of breath. The American West might as well have been Australia, for how shocked most East Coast natives were at her having come all this way.
You've come all this way? Gosh! What does your father do? Is he a cowboy?
He sells medals. Clara deliberately used the present tense instead of the past when speaking of her family's fortunes, now their misfortunes. Her father's fraudulent scheming was no longer any of Clara's concern, nor of anyone else's. Luckily, Nadine went on and on about her own father's real estate business, more for Oliver's benefit than Clara's, as Clara quickly finished her meal. She looked up at the clock. I must go. The doors will be opening soon. But there was no slipping away. Nadine locked arms with Clara as they walked out of the restaurant, as if they'd been friends for years. To the left and right, Ramps sloped back up to the concourse, framed by glorious marble arches, and a vaulted ceiling rose above their heads in a herringbone pattern. Clara had tried to duplicate the earth and sable tones of the tiles in one of her illustrations to be shown tonight.
Wait, before we go, stand over there.
Oliver pointed to a spot where two of the arches met.
Face right into the corner and listen carefully.
Clara had no time for games, but watched as Nadine did as she was told. Oliver took up a spot at the opposite corner and mouthed something Clara couldn't hear. Nadine giggled.
What's so funny? Clara asked. You've got to try it. We're in the Whispering Gallery.
Begrudgingly, Clara took up Nadine's position.
Clara, Clara.
The words drifted over her like a ghost. Oliver might as well have been standing close by, speaking right into her ear. She looked up, trying to figure out how the shape of the ceiling transmitted sound waves so effortlessly. She faced the corner again. Recite a poem to me. For a moment, she wasn't sure if he would. Then the disembodied voice returned.
That whisper takes the voice of a spirit speaking to me, close but invisible, and throws me under a spell.
She swore she could feel the heat of Oliver's breath. They locked eyes as they met once again in the center of the space.
Thomas Hardy. The poem's called In a Whispering Gallery,
Oliver volunteered. Nadine crossed her arms, indignant. You didn't recite verse to me.
I'll regale you next time, I promise. For now, I must head to a poetry reading downtown and amass further inspiration.
Clara shook hands and they took their leave, the poem still echoing in her head. The mob of Natalie-dressed art lovers trying to squeeze their way through the gallery's doorway had already backed up to the elevator by the time Clara and Nadine arrived. They toddled through, taking small steps so as not to get their toes crushed, until they were safely inside. The Grand Central Art Galleries predated the school by 2 years, when a businessman turned artist named Walter Clark had enlisted the help of John Singer Sargent to convert part of the sixth floor into a massive exhibition space, a kind of artists' cooperative, where commissions were kept to a minimum. Clara stopped by at least once a week to see the latest works, and she encouraged her students to do the same. The rooms were rarely empty, as visitors to New York and everyday commuters continually drifted through. Tonight, the room buzzed with energy. The faculty's work would stay up for a week before being replaced with the students' work, a celebration of the school's spring term and its growing prestige. Clara's illustrations would be on the same walls that once displayed Sargent's portraits. The thought made her giddy. Located on the south side of the terminal, the Grand Central Art Galleries were 4 times as long as they were wide, a warren of rooms and hallways, 20 in all, that encouraged visitors to circulate in a counterclockwise manner without ever having to double back. Clara scanned the walls of the first gallery for her work, with no luck. In the middle of the space, the sculpture teacher stood beside a table featuring 2 nymphs, both nude, one standing on a turtle.
Now that's unremarkable, said Nadine.
Clara agreed, but kept her mouth shut. They continued on, to where a group of students surveyed an oil of an ungainly horse. Towering above them all was the artist, an instructor for the life drawing and painting class. Clara had seen him a few times before. A foreigner, he was known to sing loudly during his classes and even dance about at times. This evening, he stood to the side, listening with intensity as his acolytes buttered him up, every so often tossing his head in a futile effort to flick a thatch of hair out of his eyes. Indeed, he was more horse-like than the horse in his painting.
That's my teacher, Mr. Zakarian.
Nadine sidled up next to him. Clara had seen women like her before, flinging themselves into the orbits of handsome or powerful men to fend off their own insecurities. Clara had no time for such nonsense. Back to the task at hand. The air had become stifling as more people crammed in. She ventured into room after room before circling back, and still she didn't see her illustrations. A flash of panic seized her. Her job with Wanamaker was ending soon. They'd recently announced that they'd be using only in-house artists going forward. Her salary of $75 a month from teaching covered her expenses, but not much more, and she could not count on the next term. She wormed her way back one more time through the maze-like space. Nothing. Down one hallway, off to the right, was a door marked Sales Office. She'd passed by it in her first go-round, assuming it to be a place for clerks to write up invoices. The door stood halfway open, the lights on. She peered inside. It was more a closet than a room, with a scratched-up desk against one wall and a wooden file cabinet wedged into a corner. There, above the desk, equally spaced apart and centered on the wall with great care, were her illustrations. By the time she found Mr. Lorette, Clara's limbs shook with rage. He was in an animated conversation with Mr. Zakarian, while Mrs. Lorette looked on. Clara had met her in passing at one of the faculty get-togethers, awed by the puffy, out-of-date pompadour that perched on the woman's head like a long-haired cat. She inserted herself into the group. "Mr. Lorette, my illustrations have been hung in a back office. A back office!" While Mr. Lorette sputtered at her rudeness, she continued on. "I am a faculty member of the School of Art, and yet my work has been placed in a cave where no one would think to go."
"I am sorry, Miss Darden. We were in a tight spot, you see."
He paused.
"Quite literally."
As Mr. Lorette laughed at his own joke, Clara noticed the editor of Vogue headed for the exit. For certain, he'd never even seen her work. Mr. Zakarian spoke up.
"Where was her art hung?"
"Just off a main gallery," said Mr. Lorette. "They are illustrations. We concluded they were more suited to an intimate environment."
"Perhaps you could guarantee her a spot here in the first room next year to make it up to her."
Mr. Zakarian held out his hand to Clara.
"I don't think we've met. I'm Mr. Levon Zakarian, one of your fellow teachers."
She shook it without looking at him, her glare fixed on Mr. Lorette. "Next year it'll be too late. It's already too late." Unlike students such as Nadine, for whom the Grand Central School of Art was just a pit stop on the way to marital bliss, Clara had sunk every ounce of energy into her career as an artist. Against her parents' wishes, she'd arrived in New York, knowing no one, and done everything she could to make it as an illustrator. What made it worse was knowing she'd been given a shot that other artists would have been envious of, to teach at the Grand Central School of Art, to show her work at the galleries, only to see it vaporize. Mr. Lorette shrugged.
"I can't seem to please anyone tonight. We will make it up to you. My deepest apologies, Miss Darden."
He turned to Mr. Zakarian.
"Have you seen Edmund's latest work? Come with me. I assure you it'll give you something to think about." "I believe Miss Darden may give you something to think about if you try to shake her off."
Mr. Zakarian wore a crooked smile.
"I have an idea. Let's take down one of mine and we'll replace it with her work. Get it right out there in the center."
She didn't need one of the faculty stars to swoop down and protect her. The very thought made her sick with embarrassment. Unwilling to give Mr. Lorette any further satisfaction at her distress, Clara stormed out without uttering a reply. Chapter 2. New York City, November 1974. When Virginia signed with the Trimble Temp Agency, desperate to fill her empty days as well as her dwindling bank account, she'd expected to be sent to one of the fancy skyscrapers, where lawyers conferred in hushed tones with their elegant, efficient secretaries. Not the dumpy train station that squatted like a toad beneath the New York skyline. But she'd shown up at Grand Central at 9:20 the following morning, and as directed by the agency, taken the elevator near Track 23 up to the 7th floor. A wooden door marked Penn Central In-House Legal Department opened to a reception area where a pretty blonde with Joni Mitchell hair sat. "I'm here from the Trimble Temp Agency." The receptionist motioned to the chairs along one wall. "Please take a seat. You can hang your coat in the closet." Not very fancy, this law office, with its oatmeal-colored carpeting and matching walls, but still as good a place as any to start a career. She liked to think she was changing with the times. The 1950s, when she got married and had her daughter Ruby, were all about family. But the 70s, as Ruby liked to inform her, were about finding yourself. Of course, Ruby was more than busy finding herself these days, having withdrawn from Sarah Lawrence less than a month into her freshman year, telling Virginia she needed a breather. For now, Virginia had to admit she liked having her back in their apartment. Someone to take care of again. Fuss over. She'd do the same with her new lawyer boss. Over time, she'd joke with his wife that they knew him better than he did himself. Share a chuckle over the phone about how he'd forget his daughter's birthday if they weren't there to remind him, just as she'd done with Chester's legal secretary once upon a time. The tables had turned. She was now the secretary, no longer the wife. But what was life without a little shake-up? She sat up straighter and tried to believe it. A woman around her own age, with tight curls and a rough voice, walked into the foyer.
"Ms. Clay?"
"Yes." She hated her married name, but couldn't imagine changing it back. After all, it had been her identity for almost 2 decades. Still, Virginia Clay sounded like something you dug up in a quarry.
"Right, follow me."
The woman explained she was the head of human resources at Penn Central, the company that owned Grand Central Terminal, and that Virginia would be working for one of the lawyers whose secretary had left to have a baby. If all went well, Virginia had a chance of being hired full-time once her contract with the temp agency was up.
"Have you worked for attorneys before?" asked the woman.
Virginia had already forgotten the woman's name. She really needed to pay more attention now that she was a part of the business world.
"Yes, for a firm in Midtown."
She'd said the same lie to the man who ran the temp agency. But she figured being married to a corporate lawyer for the past 19 years was pretty much the same thing. He'd spent most weekends and evenings on the phone with clients and associates, and some of what she'd overheard must have seeped into her brain. The woman led her to a desk with a typewriter and a fancy phone, with one of the plastic buttons lit up in red.
"Mr. Huckle's on the phone, so I won't interrupt him to introduce you. He'll be out when he needs something."
Virginia tucked her purse into one of the lower drawers and explored the others, which contained pencils, pens, whiteout, and carbon paper, all the usual accoutrements of the modern secretary. Behind her was a big metal filing cabinet. As she rose to see what was inside, a man barreled out of one of the offices. He had movie star eyes, a brilliant blue, and a thick head of hair. Not what she'd expected, and she tried not to gawk.
"You the new girl?"
He eyed her, from her scuffed gray pumps to the top of her head. She tried not to squirm under his gaze. Earlier this year,
She'd had her brown hair cut in what she hoped was a trendy shag, but without regular trims, it had curled into a bird's nest. Mr. Huckle's gaze traveled back to her midsection and lingered there. Even if her nose was slightly too wide and her eyes deep-set, she'd always had a remarkable figure. Her waist stayed thin even after having Ruby. Her chest double D's. Single D now, she'd remarked to Chester after the operation. He hadn't laughed.
How old are you?
The question was unexpected. I'm 35. Shaving off 5 years didn't seem too egregious.
Fine.
He took one last survey of her hips and motioned for her to follow him.
Come into my office. Bring your steno pad.
The nameplate on the office door read Dennis Huckle. She grabbed the steno pad from her desk and followed him in, her stomach queasy. Mr. Huckle began rattling off dictation, but she had to stop him almost immediately. In Ray? He looked at her as if she were mad.
What?
Yes. Is there a last name? He didn't dress like the other attorneys she'd met before, at business dinners and off-site conferences. The top button of his shirt was undone, his striped tie loosened, exposing the strong tendons of his neck. But in-house lawyers probably didn't need to impress the same way ones at white shoe firms did. The client was already guaranteed.
This is a memo to files. There's no last name.
Then who's Ray? He leaned back, breathing like a dragon about to roar.
In Ray, he spelled out the words. It's part of the subject line of a legal memorandum.
Right. Sorry, I misheard. Never mind. Carry on. Back at her desk, she put a piece of clean white paper in the typewriter and looked down at her notepad. She'd tried her very best to keep up, but the squiggles meant nothing to her. Steno wasn't something she'd ever learned, so she'd simply written the important words as quickly as possible and skipped the unimportant ones. An hour later, Mr. Huckle came out of his office.
Where's that memo?
She yanked it out of the typewriter carriage and held it out to him, then sank back into her chair once his door was closed. She waited. 30 seconds later, she heard him screaming on the phone to someone. Kathleen. That was the human resources person's name. At least now she knew. The woman tore down the hall and asked Virginia to follow her back to her office. Virginia was already making excuses to tell the temp agency. The man was unreasonable. It wasn't a good fit, personality-wise. She'd do better next time. Kathleen sat behind her desk and folded her hands in front of her. Mr. Huckle said you have no idea what you're doing. Virginia shook her head. I'm still catching up on my stenography, you see. Maybe if he spoke a little slower, I could do it. I'm happy to try again. You're wasting everyone's time. She looked Virginia straight on, but not with anger, with pity. Somehow, in her head, Virginia had imagined herself as one of those fancy secretaries in the temp agency ad, sporting a lithe figure and knowing smile that emanated capability and discretion, when, in fact, she was a middle-aged frump in a pilled sweater set, a laughing stock. Ever since the divorce was finalized a year earlier, she'd tried so hard to maintain control, to prove to Ruby that they'd be just fine, you wait and see. When, in fact, their world had been shattered by Chester's desertion. She didn't want to think about that. But the images came flooding to mind anyway. Ruby popping out of her room, singing some bittersweet Donny Osmond song, while she and Chester stood at the kitchen counter like frozen statues, knowing they were about to rip her world to shreds. Ruby had instantly sensed something was wrong. Did I do something? She'd asked. Then, As Chester explained the situation, that they were getting divorced, Virginia had watched her crumple.
That was the right word. The only word. Crumple.
Bit by bit, muscle by muscle, a puzzled agony had worked its way down her darling daughter's face. Her forehead crinkled, her nose went red, her chin wobbled. The worst was trying to keep her own expression calm and capable, to show that this was just another day, nothing was wrong, we'd all be fine. Ruby's eyes went pink and wet, and she ran out of the room, slamming her bedroom door shut. They'd done that to her. Chester had done that to her. Virginia would never stop trying to fix it for Ruby, to make up for the devastation they'd wrought. Now Virginia tried to keep her own face from crumpling, but the effort only made it worse, and finally she let out a strangled, choking sound.
I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. My husband is a lawyer. My ex-husband, I mean. I thought I could handle it.
Kathleen looked up.
You're divorced?
Yes. A hushed moment passed, like in church right before the choir begins to sing.
Me too.
The woman looked down at some papers on her desk.
There's another position available, one that doesn't require typing or steno. Would you be interested?
Even if she were locked in a windowless room to file papers 8 hours a day, she'd take it. Something to do each day, a place to report to, a reason to wake up in the morning.
Of course. Thank you.
Kathleen's sympathy only made her want to weep more.
Do you mind if I freshen up first?
Ask Annie out front for a key to the bathroom.
Take your time.
The receptionist yanked open a drawer full of keys and handed one to Virginia. Outside in the hallway, Virginia turned left and then right, trying to remember the woman's mumbled directions. Around the corner, then third door on the left, or was it the fourth? She tried the third door with no luck. On the fourth, her key slid in the lock. She stepped inside and fumbled for the light switch, expecting to see a row of porcelain sinks and grungy tile walls. Instead, she stood in a small foyer where a painted sign along one wall read, "The Grand Central School of Art," in gold letters. Handsome Art Deco ceiling pendants threw a warm light down a long hallway off to her left. She ventured farther inside, curious, her despair momentarily forgotten. At the first doorway, it was as if the art school were still open. A dozen easels at the ready for the next day's class, paintings and drawings hung on one wall, a ceramic vase on a table in the center of the room. The only sign of abandonment was the coating of dust on everything, the vase an ashy green. A faint scent of chemicals made her sneeze, or maybe that was the dust. A large storage cabinet for artwork lined one wall, a mix of slots for framed canvases at the bottom and shelving above. She checked each room, counting 5 studios in total, amazed at her find. A mummified art school at the top of Grand Central. The last room was some kind of storage area, filled with wooden crates stacked haphazardly on top of one another. The crate closest to her had been opened. A crowbar lay on the floor nearby. Inside, Virginia discovered course catalogs, accounting ledgers, and notebooks filled with names of students and tuition figures. A winter catalog from 1928 offered a snapshot of life right before the Depression, when a portrait painting class cost $14 a month. She shouldn't linger. Kathleen was waiting for her, and she had yet to find the bathroom. But as she turned to go, an entire wall filled with artwork stopped her in her tracks. Still lifes, portraits, landscapes, some on yellowed canvas and others on brittle tea-colored paper. Her eye was drawn to a familiar tableau that Virginia recognized as a Renoir, the festive one of the boating party. But in this version, a figure clutched a bottle of Coke, of all things. Surrounded by such ruined beauty, the faded artifacts of students who had once worked diligently and were now God knew where, Virginia burst into tears. At her recent failures, at the way her world was no longer within her control. She grabbed a tissue from her purse. As she wiped under her eyes, she caught sight of a sketch of women wearing vintage tailored suits, like something from an old newspaper ad. For the well-dressed secretary was written at the very top. While most of the models looked off to the side, the one in the center stared straight out. Her posture, shoulders flung back, chin raised, spoke of strength and character. On the bottom right-hand corner, the name Clara Darden was scrawled. Virginia struck the same pose, laughing at herself, but doing so gave her a burst of energy and confidence. Whatever Kathleen had in store, she could dig down and find the courage to face it. Today's wasn't the first humiliation she'd faced since her divorce, and it probably wouldn't be her last. But at least she was putting herself out there in the world. When Virginia returned, to her surprise, Kathleen led her out of the offices, back down the elevator to the concourse level. She pointed over the crowds. "We need some help in the information booth." "The information booth? Right in the middle of the station?" "Yes. It would be from 9 to 5, a trainee position. There's a night shift as well, but I don't recommend that for a woman. You don't want to be hanging around here too late." Virginia didn't want to be hanging around there at all. The circular booth stood smack in the middle of the main concourse, like a little spaceship. The bottom half, the same grungy-looking marble as the floor, the top covered in dull glass. She'd be totally exposed if she went in there. People would be able to see her. People who were headed off to their houses in Connecticut or taking the train to Boston. People she knew. "There's nothing else? Nothing in the office? I thought I was hired by Penn Central." "Penn Central owns Grand Central Terminal and runs the railroad, so you would be working for us. The only opening right now that doesn't require experience is as a trainee clerk for the railroad." "I don't know anything about the trains or the station." "You won't deal directly with the public. Not yet. Just do what the head clerk tells you, answer the phone when the corporate office calls down, and restock the schedules. It's not a fancy job, but it pays $180 a week. To the agency, of course. I don't know what you'll get from that." Around $120, Virginia figured. As a legal secretary, she had been promised $200. As they neared the booth, Virginia kept her head down, hoping no one she knew was nearby. Kathleen waved to one of the people inside, who opened a small door and ushered them in. Two of the clerks sitting closest to the door stared at her, before turning back to the mob of people that encircled the booth. The interior was cramped, with hardly enough room to maneuver between the high stools where the clerks perched. A large metal cylinder rose up in the middle of the booth, taking up even more room. Decades of shuffling feet had worn the floor around the tube into a circular groove, while the marble counters inside the perimeter were scratched and sticky-looking. Under the countertop, brown paper lunch bags sat next to dirty rags and newspapers in open compartments, like the storage cubbies in Ruby's old kindergarten. Kathleen and Virginia stood near the door, practically touching, as there was nowhere else to go. Kathleen pointed to a dapper older man sitting two windows away.
"That's Terrence. He's the head clerk. He'll tell you what to do and can sign your timesheet on Fridays."
Kathleen gave her a sympathetic pat on the arm,
and was gone, swept away in the swarm of commuters outside the information booth.
Virginia sidled over to Terence. He held out a hand to stop her from speaking while he explained to a woman the best way to get to St. Patrick's Cathedral. He turned a window-closed placard to face out and swiveled around, using the countertop as leverage.
"Who are you?"
She held out her hand. "Virginia Clay. I'm the new trainee." The clerk sitting on the other side of Terence glanced over at her. The two looked like brothers, both stick-thin, close in age, each sporting a shock of gray hair. Both wore the same dark blazer, white shirt, and tie. The brother sniffed the air.
"This one uses perfume. I think I may be sick." "Enough, Toto." Terence cocked his head. "No more perfume, okay? He's very sensitive."
She'd sprayed a little Charlie Eau de Toilette that morning, hoping to suggest an air of mystique and class. What a mistake. Claustrophobia washed over her. She feared she could not spend another minute in this place without screaming.
"You okay?" Terence asked, not unkindly.
She nodded, unable to speak. Terence gestured to Toto.
"Ignore him. He's always looking for trouble. You can put your purse there."
He pointed to one of the cubbies.
"Right above, on the counter, is the information clerk handbook. Take that and memorize everything in it. If you pass the test, after a year, you get a promotion. For now, you can sort all the timetables by the door. The night crew knocked over a box of them and didn't do anything about it. When you're done, go outside and refill any of the stacks that need it. Can you handle that?"
The sorting helped calm her down, her focus drawn to the different colors and letters. All those H's, the Hudson, Harlem, and New Haven lines, the pastoral names of towns she'd never been to. Valhalla, Coscob, Beacon Falls, and her favorite, Green's Farms. She could sell her apartment and buy a place there, where life was easier and simpler. Though Ruby would never agree, her daughter was a city girl all the way. Virginia stepped outside the booth with her cardboard box of sorted timetables. Metal holders lined the counters. She circled the booth slowly, the box digging into her hip, as she matched up the piles in her box with the ones already set out, eavesdropping on everyone who came up to ask a question. The inquiries she overheard were for the most part dull. Directions, train schedules, where to get a taxi. One couple wearing matching Hawaiian shirts asked about tickets for the next train to the Statue of Liberty. The clerk behind the window, a tetchy, sallow woman in her late 60s, sporting an ill-fitting black wig, laughed in their faces before sticking out her tongue at Virginia for staring. Not much in the way of customer service, this crew. But she reconsidered after watching the one with the name tag, Winston, who had a southern accent that rumbled easily through the glass barrier. He seemed to know the answer to any question without having to check the timetable book first. And he gave Virginia a wink as she circled by. She committed the four clerks' names to memory. Terence and Toto, the fearless leader of the crew and his snarky brother. Winston, the sweet black gentleman from the south. Doris, with the fake hair and nasty laugh. All four seemed like they'd been working in the booth for as long as the station had been standing. Back inside, Virginia took an empty stool and leafed through the handbook while she waited for another assignment. She studied the map of the layout, figuring she should know her way around. The gates for the trains were arrayed on the north side of two large concourses, the one she was on and the one directly below it. The ticket windows ran along the south side of the main concourse, below an electronic board displaying departures and arrivals. A cavernous waiting room, filled with street people and addicts, loomed on the far side of the ticket windows. The shrieks and screams within, cutting through the din of commuters at least once an hour.
She'd be sure not to venture that way. To the west, a once grand stairway led up to Vanderbilt Avenue, which she knew from experience was its own kind of hell, with drug dealers pushing their wares right outside the doors and along the narrow street. The Oyster Bar, which years ago was her parents' favorite restaurant, sat directly under the waiting room, off the lower concourse. She overheard Winston advise a traveler looking for lunch to take the ramp to get there and bypass the lower concourse entirely so as to avoid getting mugged. According to her map, the train operations offices were all located on the upper office floors, which ran in a rectangle around the main concourse. That art school was up high in the east wing, labeled on the map as storage. Other than the law offices for Penn Central, most of that floor appeared to be uninhabited. The main concourse reminded her of Times Square at night. The billboards and brightly lit ads for Newsweek and Kodak, a flamboyant contrast to the tarnished walls and blackened ceiling. The immensity of the space was broken up by a Chase Manhattan bank booth a few hundred feet away, next to a freestanding display for Merrill Lynch. She had feared feeling like she was in a fishbowl, exposed on all sides. But in fact, the information booth acted as a kind of bubble of invisibility. No one looked her way. Not a soul. She stared at all the faces, not recognizing anyone, and in no fear of being recognized herself. By 11:30, the crowd had thinned considerably. Terence closed up his window and slid off his stool.
You did all the timetables?
She nodded. Do you mind if I ask how long you've worked at Grand Central Station?
Terminal.
What's the difference?
From behind him, Doris snickered. Rookie question. The difference is that a station is a place where a train passes through on the way to somewhere else. A terminal, as the name suggests, is the end of the line.
I see. Grand Central Terminal. Got it. How long have you worked here?
Since 1942. Why don't you do a coffee run? It's in the station master's office, under the stairs, that way.
He pointed west.
That's also where you should use the restroom if you have to. Whatever you do, don't use the public bathrooms. It's too dangerous.
The tube in the center of the booth began to vibrate. Virginia gasped and almost fell off her stool when a wiry man with thick black hair emerged and stood not 2 feet away from her, as if he'd appeared out of thin air. Terence handed him some papers, and then he disappeared back inside.
That's Ernesto.
But where did he come from? Doris mocked in her high-pitched squeal.
But where did he come from?
Enough, Doris. There's a set of spiral stairs that connect us to the information booth on the lower level.
How many people work down there? She glanced at Doris to see if she'd do another echo, but a traveler had stepped up to her window, and she was otherwise engaged.
Just the one. He's only part-time, though. Back in the day, we had 14 clerks up here, 2 below. Not a lot of elbow room.
Indeed. If each window had a clerk sitting behind it, the booth would have been impossibly crowded. Until now, she hadn't noticed how many spots were empty. Winston spoke up.
The average clerk answers 167,440 questions a year.
Wow. Virginia tried to look suitably impressed.
We don't get nearly that many now, though.
Terence's voice had a hint of nostalgia.
That was back when trains, not planes, were the way to get around the country.
You must know everything about this building.
Probably do.
I heard there used to be an art school in Grand Central. Better not to mention that she'd been inside. She didn't want to get in trouble on her first day. He nodded.
The Grand Central School of Art, it was called. Every September and January, we'd get students asking how to get to it. East wing, top floor.
You have a good memory.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
Why did it close?
World War II, probably. No one had time for frivolous vocations during the war. There were Nazis right in the terminal, trying to sabotage the trains by dumping sand on the power converters. Luckily, we caught them just in time.
Doris cocked her head.
We? Did you personally make the arrest?
Well, the police did. But you bet I would have caught them had they asked a question. Like,
what is the power converter?
Doris broke out in a full-throated laugh. Terence smiled.
Exactly.
He had a dreamy, faraway look in his eyes.
Back in the day, Grand Central was the beating heart of New York City. Soldiers, artists, businessmen all dashing to get where they needed to go.
Winston piped up.
Did you ever see Jackson Pollock? Afraid not.
Winston, do you know a lot about art? Asked Virginia.
I like the ones who splash all the paint about.
Right. The jump from Nazis to abstract art made her head spin. Of course, it probably should come as no surprise that the info booth clerks were chock full of facts, many of which had nothing to do with trains. Nature of the job.
The art school, though, they say it's haunted.
Toto's eyes were narrow slits.
An art teacher was killed in a train crash, and all the artwork was destroyed. They say the ghost of the artist haunts the place, and no matter how hard Penn Central tries, no one will rent it.
Doris tossed an empty paper cup into the garbage.
No one will rent it because this place is a dump. And who wants to have offices in a dump? Hey, trainee, I need more coffee.
Virginia took the coffee order, writing it down on the back of one of the train schedules, and walked to the station master's office. The inside of the terminal was dark, even at midday, the ceiling stained by decades of cigarette and cigar smoke, and the bare bulb chandeliers encrusted in soot. The whole place felt noxious. Even so, hints of its former grandeur existed. A railing dripped with delicate brass filigree, topped by a scratched oak handrail. Even flaking paint couldn't obscure the ornamental detail of the metalwork. Virginia found the coffee machine in the station master's office and trundled back out, balancing 5 paper cups on a plastic tray. Once back in the booth, she bolted the door behind her and handed out the coffees. Toto even said thank you. The rest of her day went by fairly quickly. She tidied the area around her, grabbed a hot dog outdoors for lunch in order to get out of the gloom, refilled the schedules again and answered the phone, which was usually for Terence. A few minutes before 5, Terence told her to head home. Not until she was outside the booth did she realize she didn't have her coat. She'd left it in the closet at the Penn Central legal offices. Spun around by the crush of commuters, Virginia decided to take the elevator on the far side of the station rather than fight her way across the concourse. She got off on the 7th floor and stepped into a long hallway with trash piled up high against the walls and a general air of disuse. She headed right, figuring she'd end up at the offices soon enough, but only found more of the same. Had she gotten off on the wrong floor? She turned another corner and froze. 3 men sat in an alcove, sharing a joint that turned the air acrid and sweet. They wore jeans and leather jackets. Virginia's mother had always warned her to check the footwear of men who lurked about.
If they're in sneakers, it means they're planning to rob you and make a fast getaway.
Typical of her mother to make such a sweeping generalization. But all 3 wore sneakers. Her mother's words seemed to ring true as Virginia stared at their jagged faces.
What you doing here, lady?
The tallest one spoke up, pointing his finger at her like it was a gun. They rose slowly, the way cats move when they don't want to startle their prey. She turned around and ran.
Chapter 3, April 1928. Clara stood on the corner of 42nd Street and Vanderbilt Avenue, enraged. The sight of her illustrations, which she'd taken months to plan, design, and execute, hanging on the wall of the gallery's sales office like some cheap prints, ran through her head like a newsreel, followed by Mr. Lorette's sniveling face and that teacher's feeble attempt to mollify her.
Wait!
Levon Zakarian emerged from the terminal, wearing a long dark coat that flared behind him like an eagle's tail. Five of his students, including Nadine, trotted to keep up with their hero.
Where are you off to? I feel awful about what happened up there.
He gestured with his thumb to the roof of the building. You didn't have anything to do with it. She hadn't noticed how tall he was. He had about 4 inches on her, she guessed. At 6 feet tall, Clara wasn't used to having to look up to anyone. Her mother would have called him a swarthy man and not intended it kindly, but his pointed chin and nose created an elegant profile that counteracted the very bulk of him. She'd never seen eyes so black, like ink, that it was hard to distinguish his pupil from his iris. His heavy eyelids lent him an air of recalcitrance, or amusement, she wasn't sure which. He smoothed his mustache, as thick and dark as the hair on his head, and regarded her.
As a fellow teacher, I feel the need to come to your aid.
She couldn't place his accent. Eastern European, perhaps? I don't need your aid. I needed the editor of Vogue to see my illustrations and offer me a contract, which did not happen because Mr. Lorette buried my work.
You're so confident that this editor would have hired you on the spot after seeing your work.
I am.
Very well, then. You belong with me. Come downtown with us. We're going to Richards, which is full of people who hold similarly high opinions of their own work. You'll fit right in.
A few moments ago, all she wanted was to go back to her studio on East 10th Street, rip up all her sketches, shove over her drawing table with its paints, trays, and rags, and watch the rubbish clatter to the floor. It would probably be better for her art supplies if she avoided going home until her rage subsided, and part of her wanted to pick a fight with this man, who seemed sure of himself and his place in the world. She squeezed into a taxi full of jabbering students, Nadine perched up front next to Mr. Zakarian, and stared out the window until it pulled up to a basement restaurant off West 4th Street. The place was full, but the owner ushered them to a room at the back, where Mr. Zakarian took a seat at the head of a long table, while the rest pulled up chairs around him, shouting out orders to the waitress. Clara hung back and watched Mr. Zakarian's disciples jockey for the seats nearest him. The only other teacher present she recognized was Sebastian Standish, who had achieved a modicum of fame with his flattering portraits of newly wealthy businessmen and their families. He led the antique drawing class, where beginner students were taught to draw from cast models of Greek and Roman sculptures.
"It's old news,"
Mr. Zakarian announced, in response to a question Clara hadn't heard.
"The armory show was the death knell to representational art. Anyone who doesn't think Picasso is a genius will be left behind, sketching and resketching 400-year-old nudes until their pencils wear down to a nub, as the rest of us move on to cubism, modernism."
The armory show, where the work of avant-garde artists like Duchamp, Matisse, and Picasso had graced America's shores for the first time. Among a certain faction of the art world, the exhibit had caused a seismic shift in theories and approaches. Mr. Standish bristled. He had at least 20 years on Mr. Zakarian, and his Newport plaid suit stood in marked contrast to the other teacher's shabby lumberjack shirt.
The armory show was 15 years ago, Levon. If the curators intended to shock those of us who believe that a realistic drawing of peasants working in a field is a truer work of art as compared to a mishmash of shapes and colors signifying nothing, they have failed. I'm in no